Hello and welcome to Wise Women, the Vicar and the Witch. I'm Maggie Whitehouse and I'm the Vicar.
And I'm Susie Crockford and I'm the Witch. We are perceived, perhaps, as being on opposite ends of a spectrum, but we're friends and we see the common threads of our different experiences of the sacred. So please join us as we discuss
life, the universe and everything.
So last time, Maggie wouldn't answer the question, recommend me some spiritual fiction, because we'd already gabbled on for too long. So this time I'm going to start straight away with, okay, I'd love to hear about it, recommend me some spiritual fiction.
And right back at you. Well, Christian spiritual fiction, I'd start with Elizabeth Googe and The Little White Horse.
Okay, yeah.
And I don't mean to say it's got to be Christian, but she was a Christian mystic. She's all open to nature. She's a witch, but she didn't know it. She was a Christian spinster, you know what I mean? But her love of the land is phenomenal. And she wrote some incredible books, including one called The Dean's Watch, which is quite difficult to read. It's about a dean in a city. And he's a very good man, but a very stern and fierce man, so actually not a good man. Mm. And it's all about his relationship with a watchmaker and a clock that's being built for his birthday, and all about the cruelties of perfection.
Ooh.
And the deep spirit. And there's a page in it which I haven't looked out because I didn't research this before I started talking, which was silly. And it's the most beautiful summing up of the individual's relationship with the divine. And it's all in this very tense story about how a man has to learn through the love of his wife and the love of the people about coming out of perfection into love.
Oh,
so
sounds great.
It is magnificent. And nearly all her books, including her autobiographies, are about this deep yearning for connection. Hmm. But she wrote a lot of fiction. And one of her favourite quotations in one called The Love of the Snow is she said, "And one day the unexpected happened." She wasn't expecting it, because you can't expect the unexpected, and it's the nature of the unexpected to surprise you from the left field, from the back, round the back, when you're not looking for it, because that's what the unexpected is. I'm paraphrasing it, but it just made me laugh so much, you know. You can't expect the unexpected.
No one expects the Spanish Inquisition.
Our chief raven. No, we won't go down that rabbit hole. So anything by Elizabeth Googe, and you're sitting next to her prayer pew.
No way,
prayer
really?
Stool. And on the wall behind me is one of her kimonos.
Wow. Did you know her?
No, but we hoped to publish her. And we met with her cousin, who had a lot of her goods, which he'd inherited because she had no children and no wider family. So he was just...
Wow.
When he knew I was a huge fan of her, he actually went to a bigger publisher in the end, which is fair enough. He said, would you like some of her stuff? And I got all sorts of things of hers. I don't think she's my muse, but oh, if I could ever write like Elizabeth Googe. She's amazing.
Okay, yeah. The only one I've read of hers, I think, is the Little White Horse, and I have to admit that whilst there were aspects of its quite overt Christianity that
off-putting,
just fractionally irritating,
yes.
Really. But the rest of it was so lovely that it was worth it from my perspective. The mild irritation was worth it.
Mm.
And I suspect that had she been around now, maybe she would have been a kind of more of an environmentalist and less of a letter of the law Christian. Yeah. But who knows?
She would have been able to have done that. She was early 20th century, son, daughter of a clergyman, spinster growing up in the cathedral close. She had no option to call herself a Christian, really.
Mm-hmm.
But she wasn't one. She was a universalist. She was amazing.
Well, great. Okay, so I'm gonna match you a book for a book.
Yes, that's great. You do that.
I loved a book called Witchlight by Susan Fletcher. And it's also, hilariously, it's also a book called Korag, which was clearly published first as Korag and then as Witchlight. And the description on booksellers' lists is slightly different. So I got really excited because I thought she'd written two and they were kind of vaguely similar.
But in fact, there's only one.
No. Well, he's disappointed
when the exact same book turned up. And then guttingly just gave it straight to the local charity shop rather than thinking, this is one of my favourite books, I should keep this copy so that I can give it to somebody.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, Witchlight by Susan Fletcher, set in the Highlands after the terrible slaughter at Glencoe. Uh-huh. And our heroine is accused of witchcraft, and it is her story. It's years since I read it now, but as I recall, it's her story as told to someone. She's in her cell awaiting her trial, and she's telling this man her story. And to me, one of the most beautiful things about this story is her utter love for the land. And she describes herself as a woman much more for, I think she calls herself, I'm much more for the animals than for people.
Mm.
And it's, yeah, it's a beautiful story. And it's clearly time I reread it, because I can't remember a huge amount about it beyond that, except for some kind of visual memories, because what happens to me is when I read a book, I make pictures in my head of the book, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
But then I'm not necessarily always remembering exactly the right book, because the pictures in my head, you know, come from all sorts of places. But anyway, yeah, I really loved that. And then another, which I would also call magical fiction, is my very dear friend Terry Windling, who lives down the road in Chagford, wrote a book called The Woodwife. And again, that is a book where the world of the protagonist, who is, as I recall, I think she's a writer researching another writer, as I recall, but the aliveness of the spirit of the land and of the many spirits in that book is wonderful. Oh my goodness, and I'm really on a roll now. Anything at All by Charles de Lint. He is a Canadian writer who's barely heard of in the UK. And he also writes of an inspirited world, this world, but a totally inspirited world where humans and the spirits can have clear conversations, and the spirits are involved in human affairs in such a way as to really empower what for me is the world I live in, but to make that world available to the reader without them having to accept any kind of doctrine about anything. I really, really like his writing.
This is fascinating, because of course I'm coming from my heritage and you're coming from your heritage. So I'm thinking, yes, I'd really like to read that, and I don't have anything much like that to offer you, but then I don't need to, because I can learn from you. So that's wonderful. I'm going to go straight to Richard Matheson, What Dreams May Come.
Ooh, I've heard of that.
There's a movie with Robin Williams, but they softened the ending on it. It's basically about life after death, but it's about a life of tragedy. He dies in a car crash, but his wife commits suicide. Don't say that anymore. Takes her own life, because both their children are killed in a car crash, and he is, and she can't handle it. And the whole story is about how he redeems her soul on the other side.
Oh, wow.
Because when she died, she was in so much distress, she couldn't see heaven.
Right.
And it's savage in a way about what happens to souls who haven't lifted their energy when they die. And I don't think it's quite that bad, but there is a moral in it that, if you know, we seeking our own happiness is so important, because heaven is here now.
Mm-hmm.
And when we die, it doesn't change that much. So if we're utterly, utterly miserable now, when we go through, we're not going to get that much happier without a lot of help. But the message of the book is that there is that help from both sides. No soul is left unattended.
Yeah.
No soul is left to imagine it's in hell.
Yeah, yeah.
But
there's a vicar in a blue panda waiting to come and help
you. Well, there is that. That's an extremely good spiritual book,
yes,
I think.
Indeed.
And unfortunately, this summer I've been distracted from following up, finishing the sequel, but it's there.
Mm-hmm.
It's there. So Tales of the Blue Panda, spiritual fiction, absolutely. But What Dreams May Come, the movie's astonishing. And I would, and the book takes is deeper than the movie, but of course you've got to do that. And while I'm on a roll, David Mitchell, who wrote Cloud Atlas.
Mm-hmm.
Cloud Atlas is a story about reincarnation and karma. And in the trailer, it's basically saying, somebody's saying, why are you rereading old letters? He said, I'm trying to work out why we make the same mistakes again.
Mm.
And the characters, actors play characters at different stages of incarnation. It's taken linearly into a dystopian future,
mm-hmm.
where some of the humans are basically cloned robots, but one of them has a soul. They still have souls. Some of them can't contact it, but a couple that can are rescued and become sort of redeemers of humanity. And it's always the story about the one who has been discounted, wrecked, damaged, who is the one who leads.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at Nelson Mandela in real life. If you haven't been through the darkness, you can't lead other people to the light.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
David Mitchell wrote a lot of other books, which are about soul eaters, people who ate souls of the living.
Mm-hmm.
And they're sort of spiritual horror fiction, but they do tell you energetically what goes on in the planet and how to overcome it.
Great.
But they're very human-centred, so I love hearing more from you about land-centred.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, that's funny, isn't it? I'm not super into books that are only about...
No, but then until I came to live here, I was disconnected from the land. I thought I wasn't, but I very much was. Mm. So I don't read that much spiritual fiction, but I do love Terry Pratchett.
Terry Pratchett's got me into Terry Pratchett.
The witch books of Terry Pratchett are the best spiritual fiction I've ever, ever come across because they're about learning magic in order not to do it.
Yes.
Because if you know you can do it, you don't have to. It's like I learned Thai boxing so I could kill a man. So I don't have to. I can just stand there and my aura says, don't mess with me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Or you can contact your body protector.
This is very true. So can you think of any more?
Oh, my goodness.
Well, there's Ishmael.
Ishmael? Yeah, Ishmael's wonderful. Who's Ishmael by?
Daniel Quinn.
Daniel Quinn, well done. Okay. Oh, gosh, there must be so much.
If you haven't heard us talk about Ishmael before, it's basically a man talking to a gorilla, which sounds utterly ridiculous. But the gorilla is reminding us of our place in the ladder of creation.
Yeah.
Our complete lack of importance, mm-hmm. and how we think we're important. And that, again, we've gone back to the Bible again and again. You shall have dominion over all things, which is stewardship.
Yeah.
Because you have free will. You can make decisions about the animals that they can't make for themselves. So make damn sure you make good ones. And we don't.
Yeah. Well, like we've just completely and utterly forgotten that our neighbours means everybody.
Yeah.
And that everybody has an equal right to light, air, a home, food, shelter, safety, etc., 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 not just humans.
Yeah.
Did you see that? Oh, my God, that picture. Somebody, I can't think who it was, I think it was a news photographer who was out in the jungle in one of the places where the last of the orangutans, is it orangutans? Mm. Oh God, all my facts are deserting me.
Mm.
Live where we are busy cutting down their forest, destroying their habitat. There's hardly any of them left.
Yeah.
One of the people there, he's not a logger, he's a something else, I can't remember what he is, has fallen into a pond. He is immersed in water, dirty, muddy, a pit, small, of water, up to his armpits.
Yeah.
And an orangutan is reaching out an arm to get him out.
Oh, God, the symbolism of that.
I know.
That's unconditional love.
That's all our relations.
Yeah.
They understand.
Yeah.
We don't.
No.
It's such a powerful photo.
Oh, no, I haven't seen that. I should look that up and I will almost certainly cry.
Yep, I reckon.
If you want fiction to understand the roots of Christianity, I would recommend my three books about Jesus' cousin.
Deborah.
Deborah.
Yeah.
The first one was definitely sent to me,
uh-huh.
but I was instructed to write the follow-ups because the back of Into the Kingdom, the second one, is somebody's sister, somebody's daughter, somebody's wife, who am I in all of this? And this is the story of how she grows into her own spirituality after the death of Jesus, and how she travels to Alexandria to the mystery schools. And the third book is basically about her relationship with St. Paul,
mm-hmm.
which is not comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So they're good books. A lot of people have read the first ones, but it's the question of whether you can get them onto the other ones, because they read the first ones for a healing of their relationship with Jesus, which is great. But I'd love them to read the other ones, because it's about the healing of your relationship with yourself and the bigger God beyond that.
Cool.
But that's my advert for me.
Just tell us again what they're called.
They're called The Book of Deborah, Into the Kingdom, and Leaves of the Tree.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all quotations. Into the Kingdom is from the Book of Esther, which is maybe you've come into the kingdom for such a time as this. The sovereignty.
Yeah.
But it actually means you have come into your queenship power for this time. So stand up in it. And Leaves of the Tree is from the Book of Revelation, is about the Tree of Life. And the leaves of the tree were for the healing of all the nations, not exclusively Christians.
Not exclusively humans, even,
and
maybe.
Not including exclusively humans, no.
Which leads me to, I'm so glad you have mentioned the word sovereignty, because there have been a lot of conversations about sovereignty recently, especially kind of, you know, people starting to understand that our bodies are a thing over which we should and do have complete and utter sovereignty,
mm-hmm.
and that therefore we shouldn't be being forced to have or not have things like vaccinations, etc. So, yep, sovereignty is a hot word right now. And for me, that hot word, we're so missing a trick. We're missing, oh my God, two-thirds or something of the meaning of sovereignty.
Yes!
When we only think of it in human terms. And
yes.
That sovereignty is the body of the land, all of it, not just our body as the body of the land,
yeah.
but everybody as the yes. body of the land. And that therefore, when we're standing properly in sovereignty, we are once again standing in that place of knowing all our relations,
yes.
of knowing my body is the body of the earth,
yes.
and therefore I have the same
yes.
equal rights
yes.
as the rivers, the trees,
yeah.
the bird song, the snails,
mm.
the sparrows, the sweet peas, all of it.
Yes.
And that by standing in sovereignty, I understand that, I remember being taught ethics at school. So I remember the teacher standing up in front of the class and going, so Miss Snow has the right to swing her arm freely through an arc of 180 degrees. But that freedom is entirely met by the freedom of Miss McIntyre, who was sitting next to me, not to be smacked across the back of the head by her arm. And that's what we forget.
Yes.
Is that our freedoms and our rights, in inverted commas,
yes.
We are free, but we are also utterly limited by the freedoms of those with whom we share
yes.
this earth.
Yes.
The others who are this earth.
Yes.
And that's not only Miss McIntyre, lovely as she is and was, it is also all the other beings,
yeah.
those things we call nature.
Yes. And our relationship with the wider...
Yeah, beyond that.
Beyond
spirits,
that.
The cosmos, everything.
Sovereignty
yeah.
is actually standing in your power, thy will, not mine, yes. But this is my will, nevertheless thy will be done. That is sovereignty.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just changing the subject and bringing it down a little bit. I saw this fabulous meme posted by the daughter of a dear friend of mine who died recently, and she and I have become friends because of her mother's death, which just goes to show how things grow and move, isn't
yeah.
it? But she's got general neutral terms to address a group, and there's some lovely ones like nibblings, epic humans, earthlings, future leaders of the world, morning glories, homies, rad jazz cats. But my favourite one is theydies and gentlethems.
Ladies and gentlemen's. Yeah.
That's like the word, this'n is what I call them, but I love this. Snickerdoodles.
So earthlings was, I mean, it comes from all sorts of places, but a dear friend at school used to address everybody as earthlings, and I believe that came from John Peel's radio show.
I wouldn't be at all surprised. Yeah,
that he would address people as earthlings. Maybe I've got that wrong, but I think that's right. Anyway, my friend Ishvan used to call us all earthlings.
Yeah.
And much to the irritation of some, hilariously.
Yes.
But yes, theydies and gentle thems is wonderful.
Theydies and gentle thems, it is, isn't it? I'm trying to think of any more spiritual fiction that I've actually... There isn't that much, is there?
I don't know. I feel like there's absolutely loads, but whether...
Yes, there is absolutely loads. I just can't think of it at the moment.
No, well, I can't think of it. I probably haven't read loads of it either. But I know that...
Narnia books?
Oh, yuck. Much too Christian for me, I'm afraid. I mean, I loved them when I was a kid. Yeah. Although even as a kid, I was a bit, whoa, this is... So I feel like I'm being, on the one hand, force-fed with rather a large spoon. And on the second, that some of this is just so laboured.
Yes.
That I just wish that he'd get on with the story.
Yeah, I mean, lots of books have elements. I mean, Harry Potter.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the redemptive sacrifice. But I think probably the how to call it spiritual fiction is when somebody has to go through the fall. They have to go through the crucifixion. Sorry, this is Christian language. Mm. But you have to surrender. You have to suffer before you can help. Because if you haven't got the experience of being rejected...
Mm-hmm.
Then you're in danger of assuming that it's anybody else's fault because they're rejected.
Yeah. Okay.
Do you see what I mean? If you haven't actually been through something, I had the arrogant assumption that I wouldn't get cancer because I was spiritual. Duh.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. And so you can just sort of say to people, oh, well, you know, you can heal this thing. But once you've gone through it, you really, you know, all the bits and pieces to it, and
yeah, I've always said that the many things that have happened in my life have happened in order that I can truly have empathy with those who I meet on, you know, whichever place I meet them.
Yeah.
And also that, frankly, the only way to wisdom is through experience.
Mm.
And that there is a lot of... Somebody said, I can't think who it was. I think it was the bloke who wrote The Master and His Emissary. He said something along the lines of, wisdom was replaced by knowledge and knowledge replaced by information. Yes. In this information age.
Yes, we have information, so much information, technology. Very little knowledge.
So much information. Very little knowledge, even less wisdom.
Yeah.
And that the... To undergo, we're back with presence, to undergo, to suffer. The true meaning of the word to suffer is simply to undergo.
Yes.
And that if we undergo and are present to a broad range of experiences, there is every chance we are going to emerge the other end of those experiences with some level of wisdom.
Yes.
And that that has nothing to do with information.
Nothing at all. No. And most of, social media is all information.
Well, not even, is it? I mean, it's just bollocks.
Yeah, a lot of it is bollocks. Somebody put up a meme the other day about Steve Bezos. I still haven't got his name. Jeff Bezos. And how he had something like 81 billion and there are 6 billion people in the world. So if he gave everybody in the world £1 billion, he'd still have 20 billion left. So why didn't he do that? And then somebody else came along and went, bad maths. He'd give everybody $1 each. That's not going to help at all. But it was just this idea of somebody got something, an idea of information, didn't even bother to check it out.
Yeah.
And thought, you know, let's drop more passive aggression on this guy's head. Well, maybe he deserves it. I don't know. But it's not helping the person who made the meme. And another one was somebody, one of those ones about sharing this. I wonder who will read to the end of it and who will care enough to share it. And I did actually write quite a tome on the bottom because I'd got the time and the energy to say, passive aggression doesn't heal anything. And I'm sorry if you've gone through something with somebody you loved who had cancer and has suffered greatly. But this is not your writing, Mary. You have copied and pasted this from somebody else. And it's redolent with passive aggression. So no, I will not share it. And actually, I'm not going to agree with you that chemotherapy is always bad or harmful. Yes, it's a horrible thing to go through. And yes, it may change your body. But maybe that will remind you always that you've had a miracle and you are returned to life. And like St. Paul, he had an issue physical, which always called him down to remind him he wasn't important.
What was his physical issue?
Well, we think it was epilepsy. We don't know, but that would explain the road to Damascus.
Would it? What happened on the road to Damascus?
He was met by a blinding light and the Christ saying, why are you persecuting me? Fell off his horse and was blinded and then had to go and have a miracle healing from somebody who did believe in the Christ. And so that's the story behind it. But basically he fell off his horse and had a vision. But he talked about his little problem. So there was obviously something physically troubling him. And I think sometimes you have to have these reminders that you aren't on top of the world, that you aren't badly sovereign. You are sovereign as in infinitely connected. And if you have something that reminds you that there is suffering in the world, it keeps you humble.
Well, and also it keeps you in gratitude. Yes. If you're constantly being reminded of the gift of all the joys that there are by
a moment where there isn't.
Exactly.
Yes.
And that, you know, back to the, again, you know, bloody practically preschool ethics, or not ethics, but that if there is no darkness, we will not understand the light.
No.
And vice versa.
No.
That in a world without, or a life without any suffering at all, you can't really know the heights of your gratitude if you do not know the depths of your grief.
No. No, you'll just want another frock.
Yeah.
Another piece of jewellery.
And, you know, that is typically in this, as we were, I can't remember if it was last time or the time before, speaking about this idea of presence. If you're not present to highs and lows, then you're kind of flatlining in a, you know, a disconnected, half-dead state of, yes, exactly, buy me a new frock, which is... Well, it sounds disgusting and vile to me. You know, I couldn't bear to live that way. And I understand absolutely that I will only be able to love as far as I am prepared to grieve. And that, therefore, you know, back to that lemniscatic balance between there will always be those, what we see as kind of opposing ends between our gratitude and our grief, between our joys and our miseries.
And the crossing point in the middle is the relationship.
And the crossing point in the middle is that beautiful stillness where you are able to hold both and to understand that without one, you can't have the other.
Yeah. I am in sorrow that my mother died and glad.
Yeah.
And I can hold both.
Yeah.
I grieve for every dog, and I have terrible sorrow when I wasn't present at the death and I didn't do it right, but the ones where I was present and we did it as right as we could, I'm glad for that death. Yeah, and it's so important to be able to hold, stand in the centre of the lemniscate and hold. And that's what the contemplative does, that's what St. Francis does, that's what Richard Rohr does. And I'm getting to do it more and more. I'm not there yet. I was taken to task by one of the group last night for talking about failure because he didn't like the word failure. But I don't have a problem with the word failure because I do fail every day. I want to be a conduit for the divine. And every day I fail, every single day. Some days I fail better than others, but I don't feel bad about failing because at least it's saying, okay, you tried, bits fell apart again. And he had the language issue around the word failure.
Yeah.
So he was saying perhaps not being quite that successful. So and I was quite happy to let him have that because it's what, in the message he took from it. But it is, about understanding how vulnerable, mortal, foolish, idiotic you are, and how you're still God.
Yeah. And back to the vagus nerve.
Yes.
So if you can say to yourself, oh, I really fucked up.
Mm.
I did that really well. I did a great job
yeah.
of fucking up.
Yeah.
You're still on the side of love and celebration, not in a horrible way. Hey, I made a complete mess of this. Ha ha, tee hee. But hey, I made a complete mess of this. And look, I'm able to see that, which means I'm able to do something about it.
Yes, you acknowledge
it. I'm going to try again and probably do better tomorrow.
Yeah. One of the most powerful things I learned ever was Dane and Parry's rules of conflict. And the first one is the presenting problem is never the real problem.
Mm.
So you have to be present to see what the real problem is as to why you failed, why it didn't work that time. What was the real issue that was going on here? Why didn't I want to succeed here? Or what was it that stopped me succeeding here? And what is success anyway?
Takes me round to what the instructions that I give people when they are trying to construct a question for journeying on.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, just as the presenting problem is never the real problem, the presenting question is never the real question.
Yeah.
And that if you ask yourself, why am I asking this question?
Yeah.
So what is it I hope to achieve by asking this question? Then you will arrive at what the real question is.
Yes.
And that typically we have projected ourselves halfway down the alley of answering the real question.
Yes.
And then we're asking from there. Whereas if we go back to the origin of the question, so for example, my kind of slightly facile example is, if you are, I'm afraid I took this from Angelina Ballerina. It's a hilarious admission to make, but there we are. If you are Angelina Ballerina, who is a small mouse in children's stories, and you want to go, you're going to the spirits and you're asking the spirits, which ballet class shall I attend? Then the spirits can only tell you, well, you can go to, you know, Miss Otter's class, or you can go to Mrs. Badger's class, and that's your choice.
Mm.
And they can tell you which is the, in inverted commas, right one, because you know, I hope I didn't say which ballet class should I attend, did I? Because I probably did. Anyway, I'm always telling people don't say should, because you're handing over your power, you're handing over your will to the spirits. Which ballet class would it most benefit me to attend? Bearing in mind that I want to be a terribly successful ballerina. Well, fine, that's good.
Yeah.
But if you then ask yourself the question,
why do I want to be a successful ballerina? Rather than dancing for the joy of it.
Indeed.
Yes.
And that if you get to the real nitty gritty of why do I want to be a successful ballerina, it's got, as you say, nothing to do potentially with ballet or anything. It's your need to feel seen or vindicated or approved of or whatever, or significant.
Yeah.
And then you can set aside the whole dance thing. Dance because you love to dance.
Yeah.
But the real question is, how can I feel seen?
Yes.
Or how can I feel approved of? Or whatever it is.
And then you go deeper than that. Why do I need to feel seen? Why do I need to feel approved of?
Which is also a good question in its own self.
But deeper.
Then,
yeah.
If you understand why you're asking the question, you've given the spirit so much more room than the choice between two ballet classes.
Yes.
Which is all you'll get as an answer if that's the question you ask.
Mm.
Whereas if it's how can I feel approved of, how can I approve of myself, which will ultimately be what you're given back, probably, is that so much more useful. And you've, as I said, completely limited it if you've only asked the presenting question rather than the real question.
Yeah. I'm listening to a meditation before I go to sleep at the moment by a chap called John Gabriel, who does something called the Gabriel Method, which is about letting your body get its perfect weight, get to the perfect weight. And part of it's about just training your mind to understand that it's safe to be slimmer if you want to be slimmer, or it's safe to be fatter if you want to be fatter. It's about reassuring your mind that you are safe, which is one of the things that I have always worked with. Oh God, what was the point of this? Drat, what were you saying? You were talking about
asking the real question.
Asking the real question. Yes, and it. One of the things he does in the meditation is visualize your day tomorrow coming out and being perfect and successful. That's just one line of it. And I'm thinking, well, I don't know. The night before Mum's funeral, how am I going to visualize the day coming out perfect and successful? And it just came so clearly, which was just visualize yourself at the end of the day saying, that was a happy day.
Yay.
And that's all you actually have to do. Because the only reason we want to be successful is to feel better about ourselves.
Yeah.
Which is about being happy.
Yeah.
And we're chasing all this success, and I did it because I was in the media. It was what you were expected to do. And it was only when I realised, why do you actually want to be successful? Why do you want this little 15 minutes of fame? Mm. And it was because I wanted to be seen. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, I wasn't presenting who I was.
Yeah. Yeah, who do you want to be seen as? I mean, that's another, yeah. Such so a good question.
Spirit protected me all these years by making me just fail, if you like, miss the mark in all sorts of things that could have got me national TV or radio presentation work. And every time it seemed like a failure, it was actually being saved. Because if I'd gone down that line, I wouldn't be where I am now. I wouldn't be as happy as I am now. And I wouldn't have worked out why it was I thought I wanted to be successful.
Yeah.
Which wasn't the real question. No. I want to be successful. No, you don't.
Yes.
It's quite bloody obvious from your life choices that you don't. The one time you were world famous in Peterborough, you hated it.
Yeah.
World famous in Peterborough because I was breakfast presenter for the local radio station, which had a 47% reach. So 47% of the people in Peterborough, if I opened my mouth, knew who I was.
Oh, because they recognised your voice, yes, straight away. How
absolutely
funny.
And it was, yeah, awful.
Yeah.
But it still took me a few more years to realise, actually, I don't like it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it? It took me a very long time to realise that on the one hand, I was saying to the spirits, go on then, if this is what I'm here for, I'm open to it.
Yeah.
I'm going to stand and stick my head above the parapet. Where on the other hand, every fibre of my being was going, hide, don't do this, don't do this. And that part of the reason for that, of course, is the witch wound. And when you stand up and say, yes, I am a witch. Yes, yeah. I can offer you a shamanic healing or a workshop in this stuff. You are opening yourself up potentially to attack from the likes of you, potentially. But,
Indeed. You
know, which is what makes this one of the most utterly nourishing things in the world for me, but also so exquisitely, perfectly beautiful just to...
Isn't it?
To show all of what is, that this is that, that isn't how it needs to be. Anyway, I digress. But what I realised was that I'd gone to a boys' school. I am clearly a girl. I have always been a girl. And in my boys' school, therefore, there was me, and I think she's already come up today, actually, the aforementioned Kate McIntyre. We were the first two girls in this boys' school.
Right.
And so we were insanely visible, of course we were, in ways that, you know, I look back on it now and I just think, what did they think they were doing? Apart from anything else, we were not made to wear a uniform. So we really stuck out.
Yeah.
There's this school photo. Kate's folks, or Kate herself, clearly had far more wit than mine did, because she's wearing a black blazer, like every one of the 200-odd boys in the photo. I'm not. I've got on a bloody royal blue cardigan. You look at this picture, there are, I can't remember how it was, I think there were 289 boys in the school or something. 286, yes, probably. Oh, my maths is so awful. Anyway, 289 minus 2, 287. And two girls.
One of whom.
One of the girls is invisible because she's wearing a black blazer like every other person in the photo. And the other girl is literally the first thing when you see that you notice when you see that photo, because she's wearing a bright blue bloody cardigan. Mm. Even all the members of staff are wearing their black I'm a graduate robey things or, you know, dark clothes.
How interesting that they let you do
moronic.
That.
Moronic. I mean, I can't believe it. And I'm amazed that the parents of boys who'd sent their child to a boys' school... let that go. You know, I'm just astonished by the whole thing. But anyway, obviously, everywhere I went, from, in fact, the age of about 6, because I was also the first one of two girls who were the first two girls in that school's prep school as well as in big school. And so everywhere I went, I was insanely visible. I learned to eat ridiculously fast for all kinds of complicated reasons, actually, but mostly so I could get the hell out of there. Because I was this bright blue or you know.
You were made to individuate too early.
Yeah, I just became this.
You became a sort of icon, you know, this standout figure, when it was the time to be part of that tribe.
I mean, it's very hard to be part of a tribe when you're a girl entirely amongst boys. Although, I mean, luckily for me, I did have some really good friends, and also luckily for me, other girls came, and a woman who is enduringly my best friend, I would say, joined when she was, I think she was 11 and I was 12. I went there when I was, well, maybe a bit older than that. Now, well, I went there when I was 11. But anyway, after a couple of years, my dearest friend came to that school too, and then some others. And so I guess we did slightly huddle together, but also there were, for every boy who, for example, set fire to the back of my head as I was going downstairs, there would be a boy who was kind and lovely and just treated me as a human being.
Yeah.
And I did receive, you know, much open-hearted kindness in an environment that could have been utterly miserable.
Girls can also set fire to other girls' heads.
I bet.
I'm doing the other supermarkets also.
Right,
I was in all girls' school after prep school where there were boys, which was, I liked the boys. But the girls were just as mean to each other as different generations.
Do you know what? My experience was, in that boys' school, obviously sometimes girls would come over and have dances or, you know, be a friend or a sister or whatever. And my experience was, absolutely truthfully, that the girls were far more horrible to each other than the boys were, and far more horrible to me than the boys ever were.
Yeah, I'd agree on that. Yeah. So maybe we need to talk next time about the female hatred for the female.
Maybe. Are we already out of time?
We are. We're on 41 minutes. Because I could just go straight into that and say, you know, where are we our own worst enemies, the women? Where are we not contributing to the growth of this planet? Where are we refusing to stand up?
Where are we not in our sovereignty?
Where are we not in our sovereignty? And where are we not sisters?
Yeah.
Because so much of the world's problems are women-led because we won't be sisters.
Which for me is, again, oh, let's not go there now. If we've only got a few seconds to talk about it, it's not worth it. No. Should we just save this for next time?
Yes, absolutely, because it's a whole rich vein of discussion backwards and forwards about how incredibly supportive we are and incredibly unsupportive. But that's for another time, but we better make a note of that, I think.
Yes, okay.
Yes, sisterhood.
Yes, lots of love.
Thank you.
To all you sisters as well.
And all brothers. You sisters of all genders, sexes and species.
Indeed.
Because we're all brothers and sisters.
We are.
We are, and we're all just walking each other home.
Yeah. I like that phrase.
Ram Dass, not me.